Hello, and welcome to Brave Space Live, where we're having tough conversations around anti-oppression, communal healing. I'm Tyshell. I'm a diversity, equity, and inclusion practitioner and learning consultant, and this is my co-host.
Hi, I'm Mel. I'm an author and a social ethicist.
I don't know why I felt so silly doing it, but I was like, this is welcome to. So I just want to ask, well, first, let me introduce our topic. So today we'll be talking about stories of justice in higher ed. And just so happens, I used to work in higher ed and I brought one of my friends along with me. So we'll meet her in a second. But I have to ask, I follow you on social media because I'm a fan of your garden. And I heard you got your first blueberry today.
It was a big deal for me. I live in the state of Maine and blueberries are a huge deal in Maine. So I planted some blueberry bushes. We saw our first blueberry turn blue. It's probably gonna be ready to eat tomorrow, but it's like, you know, growing food, it makes you appreciate all the time and energy that goes into growing food. Since I became a gardener, walking into the grocery store, it's like every single melon and every single squash that you see, it's like all the people hours and the resources that went into producing that one thing. And I know it sounds silly to get excited about a blueberry, but when you see it every single day and you're waiting for it, it's magical. It's absolutely magical. So yes, my blueberry is the big
blueberry. I love that. I hope you have like a grand plate with that one blueberry on it and a fork and a knife, and you cut it and you share it with your partner and you're like, this is our blueberry. We made it from scratch.
We cut it in half.
Yeah, exactly. Like very cartoon Tom and Jerry type of cutting it in half. So
I'm definitely gonna do it. How about you? How's your week been?
It's been good. I've been doing some reading. You know, I'm a big reader, so I've been reading new books. I've challenged myself to read one book every month, and my book for July, and I'll give a good plug because it's been a really good book, White Tears, Brown Scars by Ruby Hamad, and it talks about white feminism and how feminism hasn't really necessarily benefited brown women. So I'm loving it and learning more. And really, I think for me, the learning has been on and outside of the U.S. context, because I feel like and I'm not going to speak for everybody, but my U.S. education system, you don't learn so much about other countries. You do like world history. I feel like I know more about Mesopotamia than present day Palestine, right? So I've been loving getting her conceptualization of Australia and what we call the Middle East and how that affects people. And it's very current. So I've been loving that.
That sounds like a great book. Wonderful. Thank you for the recommendation.
It has. So I would like to introduce our guest. I'll say she's a personal friend of mine, but I'll let Mel read her bio, because I would like probably giggle and be like, but she did this. And on top of that, so one of my dear, dear friends, we used to work in New York City together. We'll probably talk a lot about that. But Letitia, and I'll let Mel read her bio.
Letitia Tajuba is a former educator, K-12 and higher education, and public servant with a career working in DEIB, residence life, athletics, and much more, while simultaneously volunteering for political campaigns, nonprofits that benefit the youth, and conservation. Letitia is enjoying a reprieve from education and working in corporate aviation. Wow, that's quite a jump. So we're excited to welcome Letitia to the show. Welcome, Letitia.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
I saw she wrote in our we have a chat going. She said she got my name right. I was like, we practiced, we worked on it.
We did.
And also, we know how important names are, right?
Yes.
So I'll tell a little bit of because Letitia and I know each other really well. So Mel, I'll tell you a little bit about how we know each other. So we worked in New York City at an institution. For any of our students listening, they know who we are. But we worked together, and it's so funny because Letitia and I are quite opposite in personality. And I was a part of her interview process. Like, we took her out to lunch And I was like, she likes sports. She's into band. I don't think we're going to be friends. And she looked at me and said, we are the only two Black people in this department. We're going to be friends. And I was like, you are absolutely right. And we have been friends since that day. And really having to lean on each other through a lot of the things that we went through at said, as I said with our last guest, our at said institution. So, Letitia, tell us a little bit about yourself. Make that that bio come alive.
So I'm originally from Wichita, Kansas. I always, that's like my favorite thing in the world because people will be like, you seem so cool. And I'm like, I'm from Kansas. I'm from the middle of the country. I'm from where the wheat grows and the breadbasket of the world. And I love it. And I love, I'm so proud to be from Wichita and that sort of stuff. I am a, as you probably can hear from my last name, I'm Ugandan American, but I just got my official card for the Muscogee Creek Nation. So on my mom's side, they're Muscogee Creek and Black, and on my dad is full-blooded Ugandan, an immigrant of this country. So I got the best of both worlds, as I like to say. And I have been in education. I was in education for almost 18 years. So I started off in DC, worked in East Oakland, got my little kind of whiff of higher ed and was like, hey, let me try this. Moved out to California and attended, and I don't mind saying my institution that I worked, that I got my master's at, attended the University of San Francisco. So it's a Jesuit institution, and ended up going on a huge tour of America. So I right now, I call it a tour of America because as soon as I say how many states I live in, people start looking at me crazy. So Texas is my, I live in Texas right now where I work in, I work at corporate aviation. So there's a couple places you could think of. And Texas is my 11th state that I've lived in. So that can give you just a place of just how diverse and how crazy things are. I've worked in conservation. I worked at national parks. I've worked, I think when I said youth development, I was like, I should have said Black youth development because that's like been the thing I push for. And there's just a lot of things that I do behind the scenes that I don't think I mentioned. So like, yes, I was in the band. I played the tuba and my last name is Tajuba. And I did that on purpose in college because I was like, y'all are never going to forget me. I didn't do it in high school because like my high school, they would have made fun of me quite a bit. I like eased on in high school. And then once I got really good, Kansas State University recruited me for their band. So I know that my section leaders are probably going to be like, why does she have her formal name on here when we don't call her that? And so it's just been that. But I've been in education and higher ed and looking at the justice part. I was a history teacher in D.C., taught history out in East Oakland, California, and then just found ways to incorporate history creatively, history and social justice within my roles in athletics and residence life and diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging.
I love that. So one of the reasons when we started talking about, because we first started this conversation, and I'll go back to where we started so our listeners know why we even changed the episode. After the SCOTUS affirmative action decision came down, we started thinking, like, we really need to talk about this. It's very topical. And I know that if I'm talking history and I'm talking law, I'm calling Letitia. We're talking about it. And I know we have another guest joining us to talk about what it means, what it looks like, and what it means for many of us and where it might be going as we look at this. But I was like, I have to talk to Letitia because we both worked in higher education. And honestly, I feel like this is where justice often starts, right? So there's, you know, we always talk about getting involved in local government and your school boards and things like that. But so many, and through the 60s and the civil rights movement, and even before, so many sit-ins and protests start with students that we wanted to talk about all of these stories of justice in higher ed. And I was thinking about this particular one that Letitia and I were talking about, and Letitia, you can share with us, in how sit-ins even gave us even Black studies, African-American studies, and so many schools having departments knowing that that governor of Florida is trying to repeal them and take them away. So I know you know a little bit more about how that happened. So share with us a little bit. Go ahead, Mel.
I just want to say, before we forget to announce our second guest of the night, we need to make sure to say we are extremely excited to have Kasim Rashid, who is an attorney, a human rights attorney, and we'll get into more introducing him when he comes on for the second half of the show, so please stay tuned. But I will be right back, but I'm excited, Letitia, to hear your answer to Tyshel's question. One moment.
No problem. So go ahead. You can share what you know about how justice has started in higher education. I think this is so important.
So first and foremost, understanding, so context is like my number one strength. So that's the funny part. I think that one of the things that people need to recognize is that justice in higher ed started quite a few times, ironically, with SCOTUS. So you have different cases that happened that integrated a lot of the graduate schools and that sort of stuff throughout the early 20th century. And then it ended up breaking down and having Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. But then also with sit-ins actually started in Wichita, Kansas. Like, the lady at my church was one of the folks who did it. Her name is Sister Rosie Hughes. And that I didn't know as a kid until, like, she told me, gave me a note about it. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And then when I said it to one of my people, they were like, wait a minute, you went to church with her and you didn't tell us? I was like, I didn't know I had to tell people. But then I think that when it came down and when it grew, so when it got to North Carolina A&T with trying to get sit-ins to integrate, we started seeing San Francisco State being the first school to get ethnic studies. And so San Francisco State, with most notably the actor Danny Glover, who in the 1960s was a part of this whole movement of getting ethnic studies, and it grew. So, like, once, I always tell people when it comes to education stuff, once California goes, so does America. Once Massachusetts goes, so does America. Don't believe me? Affordable Care Act, that was for a plan from Massachusetts. So it's very much to a point where if, like, we can look at ethnic studies and how it grew, but it was really the students from San Francisco State who did the sit-ins, who did this stuff, and they didn't have the social media. They didn't have cameras and that sort of stuff. They literally organized in that sense. Personally, for me, when I was at Kansas State University, one of my mentors, her name is Dr. Myra Gordon. She was part of the 1969 administrative building takeover at Cornell University, which was about stopping the white fraternity folks, brothers, from going off and, like, harassing Black women on campus, but also to getting Black studies as well. And she was very prominent in getting, kind of like, pushing the narrative forward when it comes to that. So, like, ethnic studies, Black student unions, Black grads, all that kind of stuff has started in the 60s at a lot of PWIs and kind of grew. One of those big things that have been happening is the Big 12 Conference on Black Student Governments, which is the longest running student-led conference in the country. And it is all the Big 12 schools. So even it started at Mizzou, which we are, for those who don't know, it's in the SEC. I know that's a sports, like, Tyshel's like, Letitia, you know your sports, but it's in the SEC. And from there, we, like, get together for, like, four meetings. And the third meeting in February is the bigger conference where we do we step show, gospel stuff. But we also talk about the things that are affecting each of those universities at the time. So, like, I think the one time when I was at, when it was hosting at Kansas State University my freshman year, all the way back in 2004, we had a thing about University of Colorado in Boulder where they were advocating for the family of the first Black graduate of University of Colorado to be able to walk, because she wasn't able to walk during her first, at the time when she was graduating. Like, they told her she was going to walk and they tricked her and had a white woman go walk for her. So being able to go and advocate and work with that. So justice, it's always there. I never thought that I did it all the time. I was just like, I just want to do the right thing.
Right. And I mean, I think that comes up when we try to do this work. I mean, I'll say, even in the institution that we worked in New York City, it came up so often. We've seen, especially, fortunately/unfortunately, Mel, we both were working there during when Trump was elected. So we saw, so it was like a, sometimes a divided campus, because also we were living in the city where Fox News is filmed. So I'll say one of the things that I thought about when we started talking about SCOTUS and we started talking about stories of justice in higher ed was I've literally had to do roommate. So when you live on campus, you often live with people you don't know. This is the first time students are getting to be around each other. I've had to do roommate conflicts based on who voted for who. And that is a really interesting conversation to have with somebody, to tell them, like, just because your roommate voted for this person, like, I can't move your room. But there was a lot of that happening with what we were doing. One of the things, another thing that came up is when people, who they voted for, what was going on, when the bit wearing MAGA hats was like a very novel thing. We had to have a program based on it. And it was such an interesting program because I remember this program where, so we're sitting and people are really upset about who voted for who and who was going to win and all of these different things. And I remember having a group of white male students come in and they're all wearing MAGA hats and like people are outraged. So they come in and we have a conversation about protests. Literally, we're having a conversation about protests. And I said to them, they said, I just think protesting is wrong. People shouldn't do it. You're disruptive. And I said, have you ever had anything that you needed to protest for? And they're like, no. And this is an interesting conversation because some people never have that in their life. I said to someone the other day, just this conversation about, because people always say, well, I don't want to make things political. I don't want to make things political. I'm like, well, when you are, and I said this actually to a group of student interns that I was having a conversation with, when you are a marginalized person, whether it is LGBTQ, if you live with a disability, if you're Black, if you're an immigrant, then your existence is inherently political because it's in the political sphere. And I asked these students, and I remember this because where I sit, and sometimes, you know, and I'm sure Letitia, you can attest to this, when we're having these conversations, we have to sit out because we can't tell them our political affiliation and we can't say where I voted for. But one of the things that I will say, and Letitia, I'll get your take in, Mel, if you have any questions for us. But one of the things that came up was I asked these students, I said, have you ever had anything that you need to protest for? And I gave them this scenario. I said, if there was a drug that was being made on the market, and it was for, say, like your mother had a deadly disease or something, but this drug could keep her alive. And they decided to stop making it. Would you protest to get it back? And they were all like, yes, of course. And I said, that's why people protest, because they need to, not because anybody's like, yes, I just really want to be loud in the street. No, that's a sports game. Right. But like you having to protest and having to have these conversations and stuff that people feel like, honestly, more often than not, life or death. Right. So these are the conversations that are happening on college campuses, in the classroom and outside of the classroom.
I remember when that happened with you, because mine was the polar opposite, where I had all the folks who voted for Hillary at that point in 2016 in my office. And then it was like one person who was MAGA who was like, I just don't understand all that. And I was like, wait a minute, who told you to walk into this office while everybody here crying? Like, pause.
And even having to have conversations with students when they voted for who they voted for. I remember having a student, one of these students was at my wedding. I said to them the day after that Trump was elected, they were distraught, young white student distraught. And I said, you're likely feeling the way people of color have felt for years in this country. That like, I can't believe this is happening. Why is this happening? I'm so distraught. This is how we feel on a day-to-day basis. And that person, I remember talking to them years later and they said, that really changed for me. Like I never thought about it in that way. Right. So having these conversations, these are the breeding grounds for justice, for all of this.
And I think,
go ahead.
Yeah, Mel, go. You can go, Mel.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, these questions that you're talking about in these conversations that you're having, they center around imagination, right? You can't have empathy without imagination. You really can't have justice without imagination, because justice requires that you see the world, you try to see the world from other people's points of view to the best of your ability, even though it's not possible to fully do that. So I absolutely love that, that we can talk about this in terms of, well, have you ever had to protest something? What would that look like for you? What if, like the word if, what if? It's just, it's so incredibly important. And honestly, those are the conversations that make a college experience and expand a student's conception of the world and gets them out of their own egocentric way. And I remember conversations like this in college of someone saying, no, but have you thought about it differently? And it just, that's the reason I think so many of us pursue higher education, is to have those kinds of experiences that stretch us in the best possible ways. So I wanted to ask you both, when Tyshell wanted to talk about this topic, justice in higher education, because I was an RA, but I haven't like worked in higher ed, right? I thought this conversation was going to be pretty much all about affirmative action, but just hearing you talk, Letitia, and you, Tyshell, about the different like student associations, ethnic studies classes, sit-ins, like all the work that's gone into transforming academia, mm-hmm. not just from a legal perspective, but from a cultural perspective, from an educational perspective, a curriculum perspective. I don't think I've ever put these pieces together in my mind of how much work it has been to create the space that we have now, which is why I think it feels so threatening to have these pieces of legislation come in that like threaten Black student organizations or threaten ethnic studies programs, because of the decades of work it took to get yes. these things in place.
Yo, I think when you bring that up, that makes me think of my alma mater of Kansas State. So as I mentioned earlier, the Black for the Big 12 Conference on Black Student Government, you have to think about in the Big 12, we used to have UT Austin, but we don't as they're moving to the SEC. But you have to think about like a lot of these Black student unions and stuff, they have cultural centers and things. And in 2004, in 2003, when I went to K-State, we didn't have a cultural center. We actually had like a small room for all the multicultural student organizations, all the multicultural Greek organizations, and for all of the National Panhellenic Council or NPHC. And we all hung out there. It literally was in the union. And we had to show the goal that Dr. Gordon had when she came to K-State was like when she retired, was that we were going to have a cultural center. I came in 2003, and this is the thing that I tell people now when I'm working in corporate aviation and they're talking about changing things in diversity. I'm like, yo, you may not benefit from this. But we started winning the most outstanding Black student council in the Big 12, which was a big deal because we were the least funded. We didn't have a center, but we were producing all these amazing programs and doing all this stuff. And it wasn't until like 2021 when they just opened the multicultural student center at Kansas State.
So it took 15 years, basically.
It took almost 20 years,
yeah,
basically, wow. to get that done. And it took it and its work and its effort and it's passing it down like every class and putting that effort in. And I feel like that's one of the things that like with everything being so instant, like, you know, you can make a viral video on TikTok and make millions within a week. It seems like these days and people are looking for that. It's really hard to really try to get students and other and adults to understand that like what the work you're putting in ain't for you right now. It you may benefit from it, but you're thinking about your grandkids. You're thinking about people who are going to come through here 5, 10 years from now. And I'm super excited to go visit the center because now that I live in Texas, I can actually go. I can drive. It's drivable. Or I can fly there. But it's like, that is something that like, I don't think people recognize until you know for sure. And you are right. These laws are terrifying, even from a historical perspective. It talks about a whole nother area, talks about a whole nother part of our century where we were at war with another country, where it kind of like these same steps have been coming down and that sort of stuff. So, no, you're absolutely right.
And
it too. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, I was gonna ask a question for you both.
Okay.
Well, so based on your experience, both of you working in higher education, what do you think is the most important work to be done when it comes to creating more justice in these spaces? That's a really broad question.
That's a really broad question.
But what is it that higher education needs to become more just right now?
So I'll start because and I know our guests should be here soon. But
Kasim just joined the stream, so we'll welcome him in just a moment.
So one of the things I think that, I mean, there's not one thing, but there does need to be a presence, right? And I know we'll talk to Kasima more about what the decision means and how, you know, people are being used as wedge issues in this. I think that I always encourage, and this is probably, and I'm sure Letitia will echo, that we encourage the students to use their voice. And part of the reason that we do that specifically is because you are, as the student, you are the customer. And we all know that we work in a customer-centric society, and that's the push, right? So if students are pushing back and saying, this is what we need, this is what we have to have, then we know that there is going to be some movement. And I would literally say to our students, when we would meet with them, I would say, you push back now, because once you get a job and somebody's paying you and your livelihood is dependent on it, you won't have as much of a voice. Anymore. So I think the student voice, and really making it the reason that these multicultural centers and things like this on campus exist is because there wasn't a place for students, right? I always, like, one of the things that I love HBCUs, and I would never discount them. They are a part of it. 80% of students of color don't attend HBCUs, right? So they are everywhere. That is because sometimes they're too expensive. Sometimes they're too far. Sometimes they're taking care of family. I think we need to always think about that as well. And I want to spend some time. I know we have to introduce our guests. So I'll let Mel read his bio. We can bring him on.
Hi. Hi, Kasim. We're so excited to have you. So let me read your bio and then we will bring you onto the show. So Kasim Rashid is a human rights lawyer and candidate for U.S. Congress in Illinois' 11th congressional district. And I think we all follow you on TikTok. So we have been so excited to meet you. Kasim and his family immigrated to the U.S. from Pakistan in 1987. He grew up in Section 8 housing, went to public school and college in Illinois, and received his law degree from the University of Richmond. His work has focused on standing up for survivors of domestic violence, asylum seekers, and low-income communities. Now he's bringing that experience to his campaign for Congress and standing up against the big companies who pay our politicians to rig the system against working families. Thank you, Kasim, so much for joining us today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. It's always good to connect with good people.
Absolutely.
Awesome. We are so excited that we're so excited to have you. So you have to forgive us for fangirling just a little bit. Yeah. And I say that because we follow your content. And when we thought of switching our topic, because we had a different topic, but we know that this is so, what happened with SCOTUS is so prominent and we need to be talking about it. I was like, who could we reach out to who we know does this content, talks about these things? And I immediately went to your page and was like, I follow, let's see if, you know, and thank you for being able to come on. So we really wanted to get in and have you talk a little bit about yourself and then share. We have some questions for you around the decision, so our audience will get to know more of how it affects us, what's happening, and what it means for all of our lives and how it could continue on for so many other facets of affirmative action overall, and not just in higher education. So thank you, welcome.
No, great to be here. Obviously appreciate the platform and the opportunity to dialogue, and I think we need more of this, so I appreciate the opportunity to connect with each of you and elevate these matters that impact all of us.
Absolutely. Awesome. So tell us about the Supreme Court decision to overturn affirmative action. We would love to know, you know, who supported it? Where did this come from? I've heard some different things. I think there's different theories out there. And then maybe who does it benefit? Who does it hurt? And maybe what comes next? Just kind of give us the whole rundown of this decision.
I mean, that's a semester's worth of questions compact into 90 seconds. I think broadly speaking, this is a reflection of how the Supreme Court, unfortunately, has always functioned. You know, when I went to law school, I went in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed that, you know, the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of justice and it's upheld justice throughout American history. And when you begin to study how the Supreme Court has functioned, you learn a couple of things. I mean, the majority of members of the Supreme Court throughout history have been white men who are also white supremacists. Justice Taney famously wrote the Dred Scott decision that Black people do not deserve equal protection under the Constitution because they are subhuman. I mean, he wouldn't reconcile that all people are created equal with Black people being human beings. So he's like, well, no, this is easy. They're subhuman, so it doesn't count. And scholars point to that decision as what ultimately led to the Civil War as well, because people had tried and exhausted all their means to peacefully reconcile this atrocity. And when it didn't work, this was kind of one of the final Buck versus Bell, another Supreme Court decision in 1924, I believe, that again was a Black genocide. It allowed the sterilization of Black women, men, and children. And once it passed in Virginia, the Supreme Court upheld it. When it was all said and done, more than 60,000 Black Americans had suffered a forced sterilization. And I can go on and on with a million different cases. The Korematsu case with Japanese concentration camps. Thin versus United States, where all Asian immigration was banned, period. So people who look like me couldn't immigrate. And so what we're seeing with affirmative action being repealed is effectively, people are like, well, the Supreme Court's now corrupt. And well, I'm like, well, where have you been throughout American history? This has unfortunately been par for the course. And when you see the Civil Rights Acts that were passed in the 1960s, people forget that there were the Civil Rights Acts of the 1870s as well that the Supreme Court near unanimously repealed. And it took us nearly a century later to say, hold up. And that was a short window of about 10, 12 years where we actually had a left-leaning Supreme Court. And that was a progress that we made. We had immigration reform, we had civil rights reform, we had GI Bill reform, we had housing reform, and the redlining. It manifested in different ways. But so the people behind the affirmative action decision were the Federalist Society, a right-wing think tank funded by a right-wing billionaire who's bought several Supreme Court seats. And this is where I check my fellow Asian Americans that, you were being used as a tool of white supremacy in this space. Because while you were convinced to believe that affirmative action was harmful to you, what you've basically done is further legitimize this white supremacist construct of legacy admissions. I tweeted about this. I did a bunch of TikTok videos about this, that if the argument actually is that unqualified people shouldn't get admission, fine, let's run with that. Let's look at the fact that 43% of white Harvard students admitted were not admitted on merit. They're admitted on legacy or athletic scholarship. And legacy, by the way, means your daddy or your granddaddy got in during Jim Crow America, therefore you automatically get in. And those 43% who got in on legacy, 3/4 of them would not have gotten in on merit alone. So when Wow. you compare that to affirmative action or whatever monster you want to make affirmative action out to be, it pales in comparison. So even if we concede, and it's not a point I would ever concede, but even if we concede that affirmative action allowed unqualified people to admit, if that really was your argument, then you would have gone after legacy. But you're not going to go after legacy because that disproportionately, almost exclusively benefits white students. And so this is grounded in white supremacy, in anti-Black racism. And as an Asian American whose family was able to immigrate finally due to the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, which was passed, why? Because Black civil rights leaders said, none of us are free until all of us are free. And we're not going to just sit here and protect ourselves. We're also going to reach out to our Asian sisters and brothers and make sure they have equal access to justice. And so to see that Asian Americans then be used as a tool of white supremacy to undermine the mutual success and progress of all people is really painful. And the last thing I'll say about affirmative action is this. Statistically speaking, the demographic that actually benefited most from affirmative action, more than Black people, more than Native Americans, more than Latino Americans, more than Asian Americans, combined is white women. And so, there's a great book written by Professor Jonathan Metzer of the University of Tennessee called Dying of Whiteness, where he points out that much of why right-wing America is so anti these basic social welfare programs is not because they disagree with the programs, but because they disagree with the idea that Black and brown people might get access to that same thing. And I did a thread about this a while ago that, they weren't complaining when the Homestead Act gave 270 million acres of land free to white peasants. They weren't complaining when the...
I I think we lost you, Kasim, if you can still hear us. You froze, unfortunately. Oh, there you are. Okay, you're back. Sure.
Yeah. I've given a much longer answer than I intended, but it's a great book that really talks about kind of the mentality behind why the affirmative action decision was made. And in a nutshell, it's because we have never truly reconciled with America's history of anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous genocide and bigotry. There have never been reparations paid. There's never been a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so when you had privilege your whole life, equality feels like oppression. And that's really what we're up against right now.
You said so much. And one of the things that you said that really, really stuck out to me was this wedge issue, right? Creating this wedge issue for folks. And I think about that because I remember the first time I really did a deep dive in this understanding model minority even, is that the model minority was created in a very commodified way by the New York Times and just pitting Asian Americans against Black Americans and Jewish people. So I always think about how that affects what we're doing and how we understand the Supreme Court. So thank you for that synopsis. So one of the things I wanted to ask too are, why are these unpopular decisions coming up and so common now? And do you think that the court is political, and what is it living up to? Is it when we say equal justice for all, what does that even look like? What does that mean for our Supreme Court and these decisions that affirmative action are coming down, and the multitude of other ones as well?
Well, I mean, look, I've always said affirmative action to me was a step in the right direction, but ultimately it wasn't the full solution anyway. To me, the full solution is meaningful reparations. And at the core of these issues, I believe, is a lack of economic justice. I think everything, and I will argue, I will die on this hill, that every issue we see, whether it's gender-based violence, whether it's racial injustice, whether it's immigration injustice, it comes down fundamentally to a lack of economic justice. Look, when people have access to the basic necessities of life, food, water, shelter, healthcare, education, clothing, when people are made whole on those things, then it eliminates 90% of the conflict that's out there. And what we see, you asked earlier, why is the Supreme Court at this point? Well, because we have a right-wing Supreme Court that was installed through lobbying efforts of billionaires, nominated by presidents who lost the popular vote 7 out of the last 8 times, voted in by a Senate that represents 40 million fewer Americans than the other side. And so you actually have a minority rule, and that's fundamentally the problem. And you have that minority rule because after the fall of slavery, you had the rise of Jim Crow. After the rise of fall of Jim Crow, you had the rise of mass incarceration, war on drugs. And now through this more sophisticated system, Professor Ibram Kendi talks about this in his book, Stand from the Beginning, that and Dr. Michelle Alexander talks about this in The New Jim Crow, that people think that, well, if we just educate people more, racism will go away. Well, no. Because these systems of mass incarceration, of the war on drugs, of the Supreme Court upholding white supremacy are extraordinarily sophisticated systems. These are extraordinarily intelligent people, really, you know, with surgical precision talking about these issues. And so it's not just a matter of education. It's a matter of accountability and engagement. And so for us to have a turning of the tide, and this is one reason why I'm running for U.S. Congress, is it requires us to build infrastructures outside of the systems in place. And that's why you never hear me say that these are broken systems, because if something is broken, it implies a lack of intent, or it's like this amorphous, you know. But these systems were built this way. And it's important to understand that they were built this way, because until we accept that, then we don't really have the motivation to recognize that a new system needs to be built. And I don't want to trash anyone or trash any part of our country. On the contrary, I want our country to build systems that uphold the promise of our founding documents of equal justice for all people. And so to answer your question of what does that look like to me, look, I believe that if you build something that makes you $1 billion, by all means, go for it, with this caveat. And that is that you don't do it at the exploitation of human beings. Insulin is a great example of that, right? I mean, the scientists who discovered insulin sold a patent for $1. Why? Because they didn't want it to be exploited. They wanted it to be readily available because it's a life-saving needed medication. Now insulin cost a company $70 to produce for an annual supply, and they're selling it for $12,000, $14,000. That's exploitation. And so for me, equal justice is ensuring every person, regardless of race, color, creed, background, any differentiating factor, has equal access to food, water, shelter, healthcare, education, clothing. If we can guarantee those things, then by all means, go become a billionaire. I don't care. But not at the risk of those. And so my core message of economic justice really revolves around how do we ensure that people have access to these basic necessities of life? And if we can guarantee that, then I believe we can solve some of the bigger problems facing us as well.
So how does access to higher education fit into your passion for economic justice and how you are hoping to encourage, like to increase that in if you are elected?
So beautiful question. And it requires us to look at the history of why access to education has been restricted for people of color throughout history. When I came on, we talked about, you guys were talking about HBCUs. And somebody tweeted to me the other day about, why, how can you say the university system is racist when HBCUs exist? And I said, do you not understand why HBCUs exist in the first place? I mean, white supremacists, after enslaving, torturing, raping, and killing Black people for centuries, wouldn't even allow a Black kid to read a book. And so Black people had to build their own universities just to have the right to read a book, for God's sake. I mean, even enslaved people on plantations were denied the opportunity to learn how to read and write because they knew that was a pathway for them to escape the bondage that they were in. Come Reagan era, the push to privatize universities and the push to raise tuition rates at public colleges was specifically part of the Southern strategy to keep the undesirables out, Black and Latino and Asian students out. So it was deliberate. Why? Because these were communities that didn't have the financial resources. And why didn't they have the financial resources? Because of the history of bans on immigration and redlining and Jim Crow. And so they said, what we're going to do is we're going to take these public universities that everyone is paying tax dollars into, and we're going to jack up the tuition rates so high that unless you have generational wealth, you can't afford to go there. That's why even right now, 20 years after a white student graduates college, 95% of them have paid off their student debt. 20 years after a Black student graduates college, 95% of them still have their student debt, because a white student didn't have the generational, does have the generational wealth to help pay for that student loan. The Black student does not, and it perpetuates generational wealth. The second part about it is, if you look at even the legal industry that I'm in as a lawyer, the bar exam wasn't required until Black and Brown students started going to law school as well. And then it began to be required, again, as another obstacle to make it more difficult. Law school tuition started to be jacked up as a result of that as well. And so the blockade on higher education is another means to ensure there's a system of socioeconomic class warfare. And that's why, for me, it's critical that we guarantee four-year public college as part of the money that we're paying from our taxes. And I want to be very clear about the framing here. No one is talking about free college. There's no such thing as free college. What we're saying is the taxes that we're already paying, instead of subsidizing big oil, instead of subsidizing big pharma, subsidize the future generations of our country and give them the education they need to be successful.
I've heard a theory floating around in various parts of the internet. And I agree with everything you're saying. I absolutely love everything you're saying. It's brilliant. I have heard a theory that the reason we don't have universal healthcare and education like a lot of developed nations do, or I don't know if that's the term that's still used currently, but the reason we don't have those systems is because we are such a militarized nation. And that's one of the biggest trump cards, if you will, that the military plays to recruit new cadets. And often that card is played in lower income communities of color because there's less economic opportunity. And that's people know, students, young people know coming out of high school that that's how they can get access to education and healthcare where otherwise they might not be able to because they lack generational wealth. So I wonder what your thought is about that theory. And if I am hopeful that we will get to a place where as a country, we know that it is the smart thing to do to educate our populace and give people access to healthcare. But I wonder if you have thoughts about that.
Well, I'll say three things about that. One, there's a couple of Republicans who've already let it slip out with comments like, if we provide four-year public college, that's going to devastate our military recruiting efforts. Two, if you look at the demographics of the United States, we're about 40% of color, 60% white. But if you look at the demographics of the military, it's flip-flopped. It's majority people of color, particularly infantry and frontline. And three, if you look at, I mean, my own personal experience, my own brother is a U.S. Marine, you know, growing up in Section 8 housing, flat broke, didn't have healthcare access. He'll tell you, he's like, I had nowhere else to go. We had no money, didn't have healthcare. I enlisted in the Marine Corps. I wanted to serve my country, sure, but part of it was, you know, what else am I going to do in this situation? And so that's definitely part of the equation. But I also want to be careful about how we frame those who serve in the military, because at the end of the day, you know, I genuinely honor our troops. And the reason why I honor our troops is because whatever their motivations, at the end of the day, they are serving the public.
Absolutely.
And when we look at the suffering that they're going through, 1 in 6 military families are food insecure. And so even though we're spending more than the next 9 countries combined on our military, that money's not actually going to our soldiers. It's going to the defense contractors. It's going to the arms manufacturers. It's going to the global arms trade, which is exacerbating climate change as well. And so for me, you know, when I look at what our service members are doing, I do commend them and I do honor them. And some people on the left, that this, it pisses them off that I say that, but it's the truth. I do commend and honor their sacrifice, but I also demand that they get the justice they deserve. There's no reason we should have a gargantuan military budget, more than the next 9 countries combined, but we can't provide food for our service members. We can't provide healthcare for our veterans. That's 16 veterans a day are dying by suicide because they can't get the mental health care they need. That to me is an abomination. It's disgusting. It's shameless. And it's contrary to the values of what this country is supposed to be. It has not quite lived up to those ideals. But for me, it's about pushing us towards that equal justice so that serving the military isn't a necessity, but it's an honor for those who truly want to serve and make this country stronger and safer.
And when you say that, one of the things it makes me think about, because my father is also a veteran of the United States Army, he experienced racism in the Army, which is part of the reason after when he was able to, he discharged. And when he came home to only a factory job, right? He wasn't able to, it wasn't the life-changing thing for him and his ability to, for our family. So he came home and worked right into a factory. That changed the trajectory. I also grew up on Section 8 housing. I grew up with parents who hadn't graduated college until I was. I'm a first gen student, the first person in my family to go to college. And I know when the decision came down from SCOTUS, I have been literally asked, like, oh, did you get here because of affirmative action? And my answer to them is, I don't know. But I had to make the same grades. They weren't, and I honestly did not get any scholarship because my grades were good, but we didn't have the money and there wasn't, and my grades were marginal because I worked while I was going through undergrad. So when I went to graduate school, I didn't have, you know, enough of a scholarship to get there, but I was able to go through. And for me, that was the only way. I mean, and if education is this great equalizer and they're taking it away and they're only taking it away for certain people, it speaks volumes. So when people ask, like, oh, are you here because of affirmative action? I'm here. And I don't know if it wasn't a part of my ability to go to school. I grew up in the inner city of Philadelphia. So it's something that we all think about and how, you know, it works in with SCOTUS decision. Letitia, did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I think you teed it up on my thoughts. So one of the things that I'm also noticing prior to the SCOTUS decision is that certain states where HBCUs are particularly, I'm looking at Tennessee State University right now and how the Tennessee legislator is actually trying to revoke some of their funding because Black students are flocking to their university at high demand because of the fact of, like, they're dealing with so much stuff at a lot of these PWIs. And I think that it's something to that level where if you can give your opinion, if you have an opinion on it, like I feel like it's almost double folded where it's like, yes, we're going to make sure you're not going to get to this school, but these other schools that are available to you, we're going to make it so hostile for you around in the surrounding area and so hard for you to get in. that it's going to be hard for these for these universities to be able to build the infrastructure for the influx that is coming towards them each year.
Yeah, I mean, and somebody made a comment in the chat that it's not lost on me that this decision does not impact military recruitment, right? I mean, that I think kind of gives away the farm as well. There's a tweet somebody made last year about a white woman tweeted this about her daughter, about the fact that so many of these schools, or I'm sorry, states are banning schools from teaching about racial history and Black history, and the atrocities committed, right? I think a Texas school book had them as involuntary migrants, not enslaved people, but involuntary migrants.
Yeah. Oh God.
And parents said that my daughter made the comment that the only reason, and I don't think she's the first one to ever say it, but it was just, she goes, the only reason people would want to erase this history is because they want to do it again. And I think as we look at how we're kind of systemically moving towards a censorship of history, a whitewashing of this history, a denial of the lawsuit for the Tulsa race massacre survivors, and an attempt to not even call it a race massacre, but a mutual conflict of both sides, all of this. I try to emphasize to folks that none of this is new. None of this is some, 21st century, new idea to whitewash this. This has been history, right? This has been American history. Why were the majority of KKK Confederate white supremacist statues built 40 years after the Civil War ended, right? Because it was an attempt to whitewash. It was a white lash against the equalization of Black people and of brown people. And I think we're coming full circle to that stage again. And so what we saw in Tennessee, Leticia, I think that's probably going to spread, because that's typically how these things happen. They try to find success in one place and they try to expand it to other places as well. And for me, this is why it's so important that we run for office, that we engage beyond the Twitter social commentary. One of my favorite authors, Mary Robinette, has a great quote where she says, it's not diversity for the sake of diversity, it's representation for the sake of reality. And if we want to have a reality in the country that we live in, we need to have meaningful representation. Do you think the Supreme Court would be making these decisions if we had 7 Black female justices on the Supreme Court?
Oh.
You think our country would be in the condition it's in right now if we had probably the most marginalized demographic in the highest office in the land making these? Of course not. And so that's why it's so important that we are deliberate about this. And I know it can be exhausting and infuriating, but really that's the path forward. That's how we've always pushed past. That's how the icons of American history, from Dr. King to Malcolm X to Robert Smalls to Harriet Tubman to Maya Angelou, that's how they've all pushed forward. And that has to be the playbook now. Otherwise, the alternative is not something that I want my kids to live in.
It's not lost on me that you mentioned the Tulsa race massacre. So my family is actually, I'm from Kansas, but my grandma's family is from Okmulgee, Oklahoma, which is about 40 miles west of Tulsa. And I say Okmulgee because it's a road. The town's a road.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up and knowing about the Tulsa massacre. Like, I think I knew about it when I was like 8 and that sort of stuff, because it was never lost on me that my family educated. But when Lovecraft Country came up, or not even Lovecraft Country, it was I forgot what HBO show, but The Watchmen. And everyone was talking and everybody was talking about it. I was like, where have you been? This has always happened, and it wasn't just Tulsa, it was like all these other cities. And they were like, how'd you learn about that? I was like, my mom. Yeah. Like, my aunts and my mom mate sat down and told us about it. So like I know, and as a former history teacher in K-12, like I remember I was very fortunate to be in DC. So most of my students look like me. So I was able to have that conversation, but I understand that where I was born and where I was raised, like I was quite the problem for some of my history teachers. Some of them loved me, some of them hated me, but
yeah,
it was some of those things where it was like, hey, let me correct you on that, Playboy. That's not what happened. And here's the proof. So like, I think that's something to that point where, yeah, it's going to take some of us to go out and run for Congress or run for local and state governments, especially your school board, but it's also being able to hold account and be there for that. And I've been working with my nephews on that a lot because they're starting to do the historical stuff where they're getting in trouble with their teachers. And I have to go and talk to them and be like, "Ayo, their aunt's a teacher," and I will.
That's what we do. We cause good trouble. Like, so Ayo. I know we're wrapping up with you, and we want to thank you for joining us. I know you are running for Congress in Illinois' 11th district. So, and you talked a little bit about your platform of economic justice. Can you share a little bit more about that and what you're hoping to accomplish with this run, and what you're hoping for us to be able to share in, so we can also go forth and spread that message, as Letitia said, about joining school boards and being a part of and being an active member in this country that belongs to all of us.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your esteemed listeners. It means the world to me. I believe that these relationships are how we build a better country. I don't engage in the transactional stuff. I really do want to think about how we can build long-term relationships. For me, economic justice really boils down to ensuring that people have these basic necessities, right? Food, shelter, water, healthcare, education, clothing. And beyond that, that people are able to live their lives to their fullest and ensure that they have that economic security. Because that's also what ensures climate justice. And climate justice to me is not going out and hugging a tree. It's recognizing that climate change is real. It's here. It's caused by human activity. And it's also intersectional. It's not an accident that Black and Latino communities have a 30 to 70% higher likelihood of living next to a toxic waste dump and therefore having higher rates of cancer. It's not lost on me that due to the history of redlining, the Black majority areas of cities during the summer are 10 to 20 degrees hotter than white majority areas because the Black majority areas don't have trees like the white majority areas do. It's also an economic issue as well, because if we can transition successfully, we're creating millions of new jobs that are paying $80, $90, $100, $120,000 a year, which is an actual living wage. Economic justice means repealing these, Reagan era, Bush era, Trump era tax codes so that the super wealthy are paying their fair share. Let's not forget that the most prosperous time in American history's middle class, when we were 62% of the economy, was when the super wealthy paid a 91% marginal tax rate.
Yes, it was.
And that's how we built our national rail system. That's how we built our national highway system. It's how we built hundreds of thousands of bridges and dams. It's how we built tons of public universities and expanded them. How we built our electric infrastructure nationally. And guess what? None of those super wealthy people left the country. The economy didn't crash. In fact, yeah. The economy was thriving. And on a single income, you could afford a house and two cars, and you could afford to send your kids to college, provided you were white, because Black folks weren't allowed that. But the point is that all we're asking for is an economic system where when the people who are working their tails off to make a company successful ask for their fair share of pay, they get it. And the companies who have been successful on the backs of low-income people and middle-class people, when they're asked to pay their fair share of taxes, they pay their fair share of taxes. Right now, you have companies like Walmart who are making $36 billion to $40 billion in profit, not just revenue, in profit annually, and their bottom million employees are living below the poverty line. And they're applying for Section 8 and food stamps, and they're doing so to subsidize the company, the corporation. And so if you're listening to this and you want to get involved in our campaign, the easy thing for me to say is donate money. But the more important thing I would ask you to do is volunteer for us. If you're local in Illinois, come knock doors for us. If you're remote, make phone calls for us. We will train you. But for us to be successful, it will require a mass movement of people. And I'm always reminded of the brilliant wisdom of James Baldwin in his book, The Fire Next Time, where he says, "I know that which I'm asking you seems impossible." Or no, that seems is impossible. He goes, "I know that which I'm asking you is impossible, but the impossible is the least that we can demand. And one is beholden by the spectacle of human history in general and the American Negro history in particular, for it testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible." That's what we have in front of us. If you want to be involved and engaged, our website is KasimRashid.com. I'm very easy to find on social media. And get in touch with us, because this is a movement. We're going to be successful if we work together, but only if we work together.
Thank you so much. Can I just ask one last question as well? Sure. And please support Kasim's run. We are so excited to cheer him on and support him in any way we can. So speaking of Congress, hopefully you're headed to Congress. Is there anything Congress can do about affirmative action? Can Congress codify it now? Is it completely dead from a legislative perspective? Like, what comes next on this in creating justice for higher education?
Well, so there's a lot Congress can do. And I think part of it starts by recognizing, going back to the economic justice aspect of it. Right now, there's a report published just a few years ago that annually $23 billion extra goes to schools that are white majority than schools that are black and brown majority. So even before we get to the affirmative action level at the collegiate level, let's talk about the K-12 level and make sure there's meaningful equity. And one of the reasons why there's such a disparity is because our schools are funded how? By property taxes. Mm-hmm. Property taxes are the legacy of redlining. So really it comes back to, from the core level, how are we investing our resources to ensure that black and brown children have meaningful access to education in the first place? And in my view, my theory is that if you invest in children early on, then things like affirmative action won't even be an issue later on, because you'll have the resources up front. And affirmative action was not to admit unqualified black kids. It was to ensure that qualified black kids would get basic access to education in the first place. And that's the key framing that I want to make. So Congress can absolutely codify that. They can actually absolutely pass legislation. But I really want to emphasize that we have to look at the more core issue, the more base issue of how do we ensure that a white child in an affluent neighborhood and a black child in a low-income neighborhood have meaningful equal access to education. Because right now they don't. It is a seismic difference to the tune of billions of dollars. And until we can address that meaningfully, we're not going to get very far in the long term.
Awesome. That's a great answer.
So much.
Thank you.
I know we're going to let Kasim go. We really, really thank you. And we'll share your info on our social so people can get in touch. If you're, as he said, you don't have to be local to get involved. You just have to be willing and be able and be a part of it. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you too. God bless you guys. Take care.
Take care.
Hey.
So I know we're ending soon, but one of the things he said that really made me think about climate justice, it gives me, you know, I always love to have these stories because I'm a narrative thinker, is I remember when I knew that my neighborhood was changing and when I knew that it was being gentrified. I remember, and I can tell you, I'm going to picture it, you know, Sicily, 19, you know, very Golden Girls, but I left for work. And when I came home, I said to my roommate, was that tree here when we left this morning? And no, they started planting trees in our neighborhood to beautify the neighborhood for white residents to move in as abandoned houses were taken over and built up. And I remember this.
Wow.
But you know what also makes me kind of mad about that, though? Because like, we don't talk about allergies, and I'm a person who has like terrible allergies. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. Most of those trees are male trees.
Right.
So they don't even use female trees to balance out everything. No, this is a personal thing.
Absolutely.
Because living in 11 states and having different types of allergy issues in 11 states is expensive and a lot. And so when you think about like the gentrification and like pollen and stuff, like that's a male tree that needs a female tree. But if the female tree produces fruit, that's food for free that food. Neighborhood, free food at that. And so they're not going, so there's, and that happened, I think, like in the 1950s. So like right when the GI Bill was starting and they were building all these suburbs, they was like, we're just going to beautify these places. And then exactly. Now we have an allergy crisis. So it's very medical too.
It's funny because I remember, like, it was a marked difference and a marked thing in my mind that, like, they didn't start building trees until white people started moving in. So he said a lot, and it really, really made me think. And this is something that we talk about all the time with affirmative action. Like, really, we need to be starting at our K-12 level, right, with really leveling that playing field and having, you know, you know, and one of the things that he didn't say, but one of the things that goes into that is when we're thinking about this, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, where it's now segregated, it's now desegregated education, that we're still as segregated and some places even more segregated now with right. the education that people are receiving. We could talk about this forever. But I know
I'd like to go back to the question from earlier, because you had such a great answer, Tyshel, before Kasim came on. I wanted to make sure to get Letitia's answer to this because I wanted to hear what you had to say. So in your view, what are the most important things that need to happen to increase justice in higher education?
I think the first thing, I mean, yes, I, of course, I'm going to say, yes, we should educate K through 12 and that sort of stuff. But I think coming from being in the K through 12 space, understanding how important things like early childhood education is and being able to equip people to that. I think the other thing about justice is like how people talk about majors bothers me. I got a degree in history and political science and everybody's like, well, you're not going to get a job and make money, but it's like, but you're not supposed to, like, your job in college is supposed to broaden your horizons and learn how to network and that sort of stuff so that you're able to go get a job and make money. And your degree is supposed to be your specialty and be able to do that kind of stuff. So I think that understanding that we probably, I feel like our society has lost, like, what is the meaning to go to college and it's turned into this like hustle mode and that sort of thing. I think the other thing that needs to happen is that we need to get rid of some of these like certificate programs. I'm sorry. Why is there a medical certificate for billing and coding and that sort of stuff? And why are you charging $10,000 to $12,000 a year to poor people? So I think, you know, broader things, we probably need to start, you know, enhancing. And I know that the current administration is trying to alleviate that and work with that when it comes to these student loans, which is a touchy subject for me right now and that sort of thing. But I think that's one of those things. But I think when it comes to our students, it's being bold enough and having that safety within yourself. If there are any educators out there who are still in the field, in essence, to really start educating folks in a way that's different, that is unique, and being able to do that. One of the programs I think Tyshel and I talked about, we talked about hair because I kept on getting my hair done. Like we would go into New York City and go to Harlem. I went all over the city. I think I went to every borough to go get my hair done because I was going to the cheapest. And that sort of thing. But it's like having that conversation about hair, but now seeing like how the Crown Act is such a huge conversation and that sort of stuff. And being able to hear my former students from that institution and from this institution that I left from my institution in New York, the one in Pennsylvania, they literally said, it was like, you literally did a program on this every year and made us talk about this. But it was something to the level where it's like, this stuff is important. And it's understanding that, like, you know, there are people out there who think that people like myself and Tyshel are subhuman and that we are there. So we have to be able to do that. And of course, yeah, stop attacking DE&I education and that sort of stuff. I have a more kind of like militant conversation, I have a more militant thing. Because, like, you know, these Moms for Liberty people kind of scare me. So, like, and I use that as a group, but, like, they do scare me a little bit because, like, they bring me back to the past of, like, you know, of 1939. So it's very much to that level where there's so many things that people can do. But I always will say this because I don't want a Black student or a Brown student to be listening to this and be like, I gotta educate these people. Please don't. You're there to go to college. You are there to go be there. You should be advocating for your center, for your RD, for your RLC, for whomever that you are to have those programs and to bring them. They got the money. I mean, they may, I don't know, the way monies have been running, but there are people, I know that the last institution that I worked in residence life, they got the money, but they like be able to do that because like, it is not your job. Like it is your job to go get your degree, go do what you need to do, put your best foot forward, have that life-changing experience and bring like with your people and your friends. And that's just that. And I would also say people like us need to take breaks. take breaks.
The same as there is a mass exodus in K-12, that same thing is going on with people who are working in a higher education because of the restrictions and how hard it is, and then not how livable it isn't as a career. And I think one of the things that happens a lot is that Leticia and I both worked in education outside of the classroom because it became such a huge part of the students. Well-rounded. I remember sitting with students, white students, black students, and them saying, okay, I'm going to get this job. I had one student, love this student from Alaska, who said, I'm going to be working in, I think she's working in corporate finance. And she said, I really want to be able to give back. How much did I set aside in my paycheck to give back? And I was like, to have those kind of conversations, because I would tell students that college is a very short time for you to go from student to full adult people will have expectations of you. And it's so important. So when we're thinking about what justice looks like, is really setting forth to push back. And I believe Gen Z has done a lot of that, right? We can tell now that apparently Gen Z, the oldest of them, is already 26, which is wild to think about, but they're in our workforce. And they are doing things differently. They're disrupting. And I think that's right. And that's the thing that we need to really, really be thinking about. I know we could talk about this topic forever. So I'm going to switch us and say, what's top of mind for you? And I'll go Mel first and then Leticia. Like, what's going on? And this could be anything, Leticia, anything that's top of mind for you and where you are. Mel, what's top of mind for you?
Two things. First of all, this just needs to be said. Can someone please explain to me how people who are supposedly all about freedom and freedom of speech think it's okay to censor university students and professors from teaching certain subjects like CRT to adults, to consenting adults for educational purposes. And they think that is somehow upholding freedom of speech. What, like, how make it make sense. Okay. So that's top of my number one. I don't think anyone else can answer this question because it doesn't make sense and it's not supposed to make sense. Second top of mind is my blueberry because y'all, it really has come up in my brain for this whole conversation start to finish of just how much work and time it takes to create even tiny, meaningful change. It takes time. It takes water. It takes sun. It takes patience. It takes effort. And that blueberry is just, it's not going to grow itself. It needs care, right? It needs us to care. But I think also it's really important to celebrate the small wins along the way. Otherwise you just get too burnt out. So I love what you're saying, Leticia, about taking breaks. To grow food versus to grow food for our minds, it takes work. It doesn't just happen by accident. And the university systems that we've enjoyed, if we've been so lucky and privileged to enjoy them, they were not created by accident. They are created by people being intentional about those things. And I feel like I have a new appreciation for my education after this conversation. So thank you both for that.
Look at that good metaphor. Leticia, what is top of mind for you right now in the world, whether it is what we talked about or anything else? What's top of mind for you?
I mean, there's a lot. Right now, I'm going to give a shout out to my nephews. One of my nephews is turning 12 at the end of the month. Oh my God, I'm old. I know. And I think I think about him a lot, and I think about his brother, and I think about all of my nieces and nephews, but those two in particular, and just how amazing and bright they are. I think during the NCAA March Madness, one of my sister and my aunt called me up and were like, you know, they're bragging to their classmates, and I don't mind saying I worked at Michigan State, but I worked at Michigan State at one point, and they ended up playing K-State, and they was like, oh my gosh, how, and they don't call me Leticia, they call me Aunt Niecy. They was like, how's Aunt Niecy doing? And they're explaining to their classmates, no, my Aunt Niecy worked at Michigan State, and she went to Kansas State, and she went to this school too, and she went to that, she worked at this school and that school, and I thank God that I was able to take, and I don't normally say thank God a lot either, so it's just me being a sentimental auntie right now. But I thank the heavens for, and I'm very grateful and appreciative of my relationship with my family, especially before I got on this. I was talking to my older sister and she was like, yo, go up in here and represent us. And understand that like we're not we're very different, and we're both in corporate right now, just kind of talking about that. I think the second thing is that was pretty dope with because
yes,
I think I was just kind of like this is really happening. And then the third thing is like when we talk about little things and little victories, like I'm looking at my hair right now and I was like, this is such a long time coming
from flourishing
to like that small little like teeny starter lock to this look right now. And I'm just like, Jesus, like I do not look like the same.
I will say, Mel, just so you know, even in our bonding, as we work together, because we also lived where we worked, is like we would do each other's hair, we would go out, and you know, so that's
she did a crochet set for me. It was nice.
I did. She let me experiment her. Well, thank you. So I'm gonna share what's top of mind for me, and it's kind of a mix of the two of what you have shared. I would be remiss if I didn't say that tomorrow's my younger brother's birthday. And I called him today. He's at the Beyonce concert because she's in my home city of Philadelphia today. And I said, I wanted to call you and ask you what you wanted for your birthday. And I want, whatever adult gift he wants, I will buy him. My little sister, her birthday was in September. I bought her a vacuum for her birthday. So I told my brother I will buy him an adult birthday gift. So if he wants, I don't know, a new mattress or something, I'll buy him that for his birthday. So his birthday is tomorrow. And our former producer, who is still a listener of ours, Benjamin, his birthday is next week as well. So happy birthday to him and happy birthday to
you. Is that workplace Ben?
Yes, it is. And we used to work together. This is how we're all connected. So Benjamin, our former producer who introduced me to Mel, I met him, and me and Letitia and him all worked together in New York City. So happy, a lot of July birthdays. And my nephew is also turning 16 at the end of the month. So lots of birthdays. But the other thing that's really top of mind for me, going back to what you said, Mel, is about your blueberry. And you talked about this in the beginning about you have a new appreciation for going into a grocery store and seeing all of the work. I really want to remind people that there is no unskilled labor.
Yes.
If I watched Mel's, her Insta story about her and her TikTok, I think it was,
to follow you so I can see this.
Exactly. It's a private account. It's a private, but you can absolutely follow me.
Yes.
About her blueberry was the amount of care and time and skill it takes to be able to grow and, you know, ward off any insects from these things to actually produce a blueberry. So I want to share and let people know that there is no unskilled labor. So when we say, oh, just the person who works here, just the person who does that, we know that even through the pandemic, that the people who are on the front lines are the people who keep us safe and able to do and live our lives. And groceries and food is a part of that. If you've ever watched a video of how people like cut down corn and bag your groceries and create take them from field to farm to table, that kind of thing. There is no unskilled labor, and people should be you should only have to work one job and within a certain amount of hours to be able to afford housing, food, water, clothing, as Kasim talked about with economic justice. You should not have to moonlight. You should not have to work three jobs because there is no unskilled labor. And I say that to folks who also especially think, I've made it big as a billionaire. Well, if you did not till the land as a real estate agent and build the house, then you did not make it you're not a self-made billionaire. So
yeah.
I do want people to understand that there is no unskilled labor. It takes a lot of work and a lot of ingenuity and a lot of know-how to even get one blueberry. So I just want to say thank you.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
And before we go, I do want to make sure I thank my esteemed colleague. And now she's not just a colleague. She is my friend, Letitia, for coming on. I knew that when we started talking about history, I said, I got to call my girl. I know she knows about this and we've worked together. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to our listeners. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And we got some more fancy TikTok folks lined up for you all I should be reaching out to all the people I follow. Like, would you be on our little podcast? Cause we love it and we care about it. And we do this because we love these kind of conversations and we love this community. So you'll see us in 2 weeks with another of our people that we all follow.
If people wanted to follow me, could you? I don't mind folks.
Oh, absolutely.
Trying to follow me at all.
Post, Yes, we will post. I'll post your handles on our social. So follow Professor Tajuba.
My high school students gave me that name.
Exactly. I'll make sure you get post. You get those things posted there. And thank you, thank you, thank you all for another great episode. Have a great day, everybody.
We'll see you next time. Bye bye.
Bye bye.